This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your pop culture podcast roundup. I'm Sian Pattenden.
And I'm Alex Andreu. This week we are thrilled to be joined by legendary music writer and broadcaster Paul Morley to talk Island Records, Factory Records and All Records.
And we don our parka and we put our hands behind our backs as we listen to the new album from Liam Gallagher, Come On You Know. No, that's the name of the album.
We go out to a big scary cinema to watch the summer's first big blockbuster release, Top Gun Maverick, Stillwood. And we get comfy in our nest to watch the latest major Sky adaptation of The Midwich Cuckoos.
All this and more on today's Culture Bunker. Welcome to the Culture Bunker. Let's say hello to our first guest. Paul Morley is a modern-day Renaissance man. He is an author, broadcaster, record label boss, musician, man about town, and lord of the high critique. Hello, Paul. It's great to have you in the studio.
Thanks for that. I know what I am now. I've always wondered.
You can give me notes later, though, the corrections. We'll talk about the Islander book later in the show. But what are you working on at the moment? Because you're a man who usually has a few books going, I believe, at the same time, it seems.
Yes, I can write books now because they pay pretty much what journalism once would pay. So, you know, I used to want to write 100,000 words for The Enemy, and now I can. So I tend to write a lot of books now. You know. I'm working on a couple. Yeah. One hasn't yet sorted itself out, and the other one is possibly a kind of extension of a book I wrote in the 90s called Nothing, which was about the suicide of my father. If only because to change the title, because Doris Lessing, of all people, once lectured me about how it was the worst title ever in the history of books.
What was her reasoning then?
Well, I think she thought that I was basically saying it was nothing, you know. Oh. I had reasons why I'd called it Nothing, yeah. To do possibly, oddly, both with Depeche Mode and Samuel Beckett. Writing books, it's turned out, is something I always thought I'd end up doing in my 60s, and indeed I have ended up doing it.
Well, hooray.
It's amazing, isn't
really
it?
Some
things work out.
Yeah. You're never in your 60s.
No, I was exaggerating that, hope.
All right.
Might say, you're never in your 60s.
But then you've got a couple of decades
I look at you know, what I was doing in the 70s and figure that I must be in my 60s, because otherwise I would have been 4 years old. So something's not worked out.
And I say musician because I know that you wanted to explore, after years of writing about music, the creation of music. Are you still doing this?
No, in a way I've returned to how it was before. I studied at the Royal Academy of Music for a television programme, how to be a composer, if you like. Couldn't believe that they told me that I could be a composer without actually being able to play an instrument, and that you could write a score. And indeed, I did, because there's a kind of mathematical element to it as well as a spiritual element. So it was wonderful while I was at the Royal Academy, because if I wanted a harp or a string quartet, I could snap my fingers and 5 minutes later, an amazing string quartet would walk through the door, or a harpist. Yeah. As soon as I left, it was back to the electronics, if you like, you know, and being in a studio sort of telling people what to do, as I had done with Art of Noise.
Yeah. But so you're not making it at the moment. Go on.
Go on, yeah.
Write my second string quartet. Write your next quartet.
Let's meet our next guest. Musician and journalist Anthony Teasdale has written a bevy of tunes and for a host of publications, including Arena and Esquire, and he launched and is editor of Umbrella magazine. A self-confessed crisp enthusiast, with a harpist on staff, I would guess, and a dance floor legend fresh from the trauma of Liverpool FC coming second.
I'm not traumatised by Liverpool's season. This is fantastic.
Welcome to the Culture Mr. Bunker.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, all is good here. I'm very excited about various football matches that are occurring.
Very good.
But I'm more excited because I've got a new record out this week.
Lovely. Tell us about it.
Right, so it's Self-Indulgent. It sounds a bit like...
Is that the title?
No, but that's my ethos in everything I do. And it's a 5-track EP on vinyl.
And oh, my goodness.
Now, I sold my records 2.5 years ago to pay a tax bill.
Sorry, so is it 7-inch?
No, it's 12-inch.
Oh, it's 12-inch.
And it's great value for money, 5-track.
12-inch EPs.
It's a 12-inch EP. And I sort of wrote most of it over lockdown. And it's just amazing what you can do now. You know, I've got, you just use a program on your laptop and you have like incredible professional studio there and then. Put it up on the SoundCloud. And some people heard it and said, let's put it out. So it's out, yeah. I think, this week.
Amazing. Jubilee weekend coming up. Any big plans?
Well, as a, coming from an Irish Catholic background, I intend to drink 2 or 3 cans of lager on up my roof terrace. There may be some, I might buy some frazzles as well, just to really show. And then I can throw stones at a statue of Oliver Cromwell.
Can I throw a horrible generalisation to you?
Yeah.
And I can do this because I'm a foreigner, so I know nothing about this country. Scousers seem to me to be the most comfortable bunch of people at expressing Englishness without it feeling like nationalism. Why is that? They seem comfortable in the English flag without looking like BNP supporters.
I would say, we can get very complicated. Now, I think it's a lot of this to do with football, and there are lots of myths around this, but the big thing that's been... And Paul probably aware of this is that we are not English, we are Scouse thing, which has been going over the last time. But now, I think that isn't to be taken seriously or particularly literally. And it's become, if you share the northwest of England with Mancunians as we do, we're all obviously, to an extent, English. But there is a genuine difference, I would say, with Scousers in that the influence of the Irish diaspora is so great on the city, you know, that you had up until 100 years ago, over half the population was born in Ireland. And so you do have a slightly different way of looking at things. I think it's often over-egged in football, and that's mostly Liverpool rather than Everton. I think Liverpoolians are quite happy with that. Having said that, I would say Liverpoolians are mostly English, but of a different self-mythologizing version of it. I'm sure, Paul, what do you think?
Well, I think in the best sense, Liverpool's always just been another country.
Yes.
I've not even thought of its Englishness at all, in the best possible sense. It's mysterious, wonderful, exotic, strange, other. It could be in the middle of the Pacific, middle of the Atlantic, could be up at the Antarctic. It's a special other country. Maybe us Manx were always a little bit jealous of the fact that it was so distinctively another country, to the extent that we had to try and drag the Irish Sea closer to Manchester with a ship canal.
We've never forgive them for that.
Oh, wonderful. Much more from both our guests in a bit.
Before we move on, a reminder, you can get the Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without ads when you support us on Patreon. That means daily episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much, much more, including aliens. They're quite heavy at the moment, plus all manner of exciting merch and special shows just for you. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
The small fictional English village of Midwich is mysteriously subdued by a force for a day. Everyone passes out. On coming round, all the women capable of bearing children find themselves pregnant. As the children grow, and they grow fast, it becomes clear that they are special and have their own agenda. This Sky, modern-day retelling of John Wyndham's classic sci-fi chiller, is anchored around a child psychologist played by Keely Hawes and Max Beasley's local police chief trying to unwind the mystery. Here's a taste.
I can't sleep.
And why can't you sleep?
Because bad things will happen.
Since 9:47, we've had a complete blackout. No communication in or out. We've got no idea what it is.
The way that I felt right after,
I couldn't put it into words. It felt like I was visited.
I can feel life growing inside me.
Whether we like it or not, we are all in this together now.
She wants it to hurt me.
This is not what you think it is.
Anthony, the book has always been popular, and there is a classic 60s film version of it, Children of the Damned. But recently it's enjoyed a real revival in popularity, with prominent voices saying it's much more than a horror yarn. Did those extra layers come through?
I hadn't thought of that, but now you say it, yes. I think there's a lot of that repressed Englishness of... There's a lot of people staring out of windows.
Mm.
You know,
and there's a lot of curtain twitching.
Do you know what I mean? There is that. Now, is that a bit of a cliche these days? Do people do this as much? But I don't think the essential nature of Englishness changes that much.
Hmm.
And there was that sort of like suppressed, you know, anger under there and discomfort. It's a different England to the England that, say, me and Paul grew up. It's very southern for me, almost quite alien, also quite exotic. But also, I really enjoyed this. I thought it was incredible. Terrifically exciting. I thought it was cast really well. I thought, what's your Max
Beasley?
As the Mank copper was great. Keely Hawes was great. And it got me straight away.
Yeah.
And I thought they explained the weird event. This weird event happened, you know. It was like when Quicksave opened where I'm from. It was,
That's brilliant.
It was this really weird event, and it's handled really well. You know, there's like people, everyone just falls asleep. You know what I mean? And there's loads of horses, they fall, and everyone falls asleep. I thought it was really fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Listeners, we are sorry for the terrible spoiler that you just heard. A Quicksave opening indeed kicks off this whole thing. Sean, unlike some adaptations, the series tries to balance the terror parents feel about those strange children with the love they feel for them. Does that water it down, or does it actually add to the atmosphere?
Oh, I think it adds to it. I think it's extremely powerful, and it's very brave of them to do the adaptation again, because what more do you say? But they managed to put so much else on there. The anxiety of parenthood, the fact that, you know, you may love something because you feel terrified by it too. The such complicated emotions to put that through, and they do it so well. And I do think we have to keep saying Keely Hawes really pulls it all together. She is so good in this. And obviously, it's the greatest deus ex machina in the world, isn't it? You know, it really is coming from somewhere else. And to explain that and to give it, you know, validity, that we all do say, OK, all right, everyone is pregnant. You know, it's a big step for us to suspend that disbelief. I think they do it absolutely beautifully. And I was fairly captivated, and I have watched 4 already. And it gets better and better. I really think it's getting better. The paranoia of being a pregnant woman, you don't see that much in narrative. But
there's one.
They got it.
There's one fantastic moment where one of the kids says, "Can I have some biscuits for my lunch? I'd like chocolate hobnobs." And the mother opens the cupboard, and there's this moment of terror where she goes, "We only have ginger." And there's a pause where you think, is the kid going to kick off now? And okay, to a much smaller level, but every parent has sort of felt that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe their children don't have special powers, but every parent has thought,
all children
oh,
have
God,
special powers.
Are we heading
something
for
to...
a tantrum?
Yeah.
No. A lot of it rides on the child actors, which you have been, Sean.
I don't know this.
Really?
Is this true?
Oh,
is
young,
this
true?
Young Were you Teagan? In the Children's
young
Film Foundation?
Teagan. We're in the
Not
same
quite.
Room with Young Teagan. Don't you know
Who.
This?
Yeah.
We are.
Yeah.
Yes.
I did some acting as well.
Finding the right kids is notoriously difficult. Have the casting directors done all right in this?
Oh, fantastic. You can find the right kids. It's directing them, and they're directed beautifully. I think we should say that I think it's all female directors on this show.
It's six out of eight.
Okay,
yeah.
It's written by David Carr.
Six out of eight episodes is female.
But yeah. I think that's really important because there is such a female slant, obviously, to the paranoia and the fear. And the kids are wonderful. It's difficult to play because they have to play everything very, very straight, and they're almost no emoting if you're an alien child, not to give anything away. Mm.
Paul, is it odd that something so claustrophobic about life in a sort of curtain-twitching 50s English village should still work so well? The moral ambiguities seem almost intact for something so old. Is it the quality of the source material, or have we made little progress?
Well, the original text is an amazing piece of work, John Wyndham. Even though it was sort of classed as science fiction, in a way it's a book about ideas, a book about transition, post-war transition. You know, something was happening, even if it was just the arrival of teenagers, something new. And that figures for every single generation since, and especially now with COVID and the climate change, and even the internet in a way. There's a sense that something disturbing is coming. We don't know what it is. It could be good, it could be bad, but there's change in the air. And John Wyndham had an amazing way of viewing global catastrophe through something local, if you like, which is where the village comes. And to an extent, they do that. It's interesting at the beginning because it begins and you think, true to the spirit of the original, which was almost a parody of a certain kind of quintessential Englishness
in
itself.
Yes, I thought it was Midsummer Cuckoo.
I was going to say, for me, this was an episode of Midsummer Murders with Max Beasley as Inspector Barnaby and Keely Hawes as your special guest star that you love because you look her up in Spotlight. So it had that quality. Which I thought was good, and it occurred to me that every generation, and it's also been very influential, the book and certainly the Village of the Damned film in 1960 on recent films like Contagion. That says something disturbing is happening. You don't know what it is. It can't be controlled. Well, how do we deal with it? And in a way, it's how we deal with it rather than fear or scary or monsters. It's much more sort of cerebral and visceral than that. You know. We're going to have to get used to this is happening, and this is now our future. And that's why it's fantastic that it's come at this particular period, because that's definitely how we're all thinking. Something is changing very fast. You know, it could even be the metaverse that's happening. You know, a whole way of being human is definitely changing, and we view it through local a village and the village postmistress and all those wonderful cliches that could almost be Enid Blyton or Agatha Christie. But the larger sense is this is a transitional period in humanity, and we don't know what we're going to be like on the other side. And I was worried because the book and indeed the Village of the Damned are two of my favourite things ever. So I was slightly worried that this might, trivialize that or ruin it. But I realized that in a classic sense of a great text, it can be changed from generation to generation and period to period. And it's the Wyndham, I think, that is the genius in this, even though it's gone through many sort of transformations itself.
Sean, the series also touches on a lot of issues about women's body autonomy and the struggles of motherhood, feeling something alien is growing inside you, the battle between women and the state.
Well, also,
for control,
What is quite interesting is I haven't seen in much drama, and I'm sure, write in if you want to, about when babies arrive in a relationship, they often are the nuclear bomb. They're the thing that destroys the relationship. This is about that. It's about suddenly that we see very close couples at first, and it's a bit cloying, but it's meant to be. We see them driven apart purely.
Played against each other.
And played against each other by this alien entity, as it were, like a child is. And so it's dealing with enormously honest and actually quite brutal and quite tough truths about anxiety and about parenthood and about the things that you don't really see. It's usually cereal packet stuff and everybody gets on.
Thumbs up from all of us, right?
I thought the sound design was brilliant as well. I said it was like Miss Marple meets Boards of Canada. Do you know what I mean?
Because I was
listening to it last night on the headphones.
Oh, great.
And it was just like this full sensory weird experience. And absolutely, fantastic.
And even the title image, which is a sort of flower, but also a bit of a vagina.
Yes.
And
it's vulva-esque.
Brilliant.
There's a great scene where they there's that nice couple they go with it. They're like, oh, we're going to hospital to have the first scan. They're like, can you go in this room? And they go to this room. There's everyone else in the village there. And she just is in denial and disbelief. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really well played. Mm-hmm. You know, we're nothing to do with this. This is our baby born from love. And they're like, no.
Midwich Cuckoos is out on June the 2nd on Sky Max and then on Now TV from the 3rd of June.
Now, welcome again to Paul Morley, journalist, author, broaster. We've done all this stuff, and you are the Renaissance.
We'll keep going.
Well, I will add the coda. You know that you are the man that Andrew Harrison, our other co-presenter, credits with helping him pass his A-levels.
Oh.
Because he quoted everything that was on Frankie Goes to Hollywood sleeves, et al.
Exactly what it was for.
Yeah, yeah. All your Derrida. It got in there.
All your Derrida.
All your Derrida. Everything you can shake a stick at. Yeah. So you helped him get to where he
pleased
is today.
To hear it.
Fantastic.
I mean, I remember buying Relax when I was 11. And all this stuff on the back, and I was like, I didn't realise that was you'd written all this. I'm like, my mum's like, are you sure you should be reading this? I'm like, yes.
Just to completely go off a tangent, everyone at my school bought Relax. Everyone, you did at 7
Yeah.
And I know that parents made all the girls in my class put it in a brown paper bag.
Oh, excellent.
We weren't allowed the cover, and this whole thing that went round, you know.
Well, what's the story? Because I remember the cause, like, two people back to back who illustrate, what's the story behind that?
Well, that was just something the band had, actually, you know. But, you know, we decorated it on the 12-inch, which is maybe what you're referring to. I did a condensed version of a pornographic novel.
All right, okay.
Which seemed the thing to do, because, funnily enough, I used to think maybe Bowie and T-Rex Records in the early 70s had that on them, in my imagination. Yeah, it was only when I went back and looked, of course, they didn't. But I figured they did, because I was so excited and sexually turned on by these records. I thought they must have, you know. And then in the early 80s, they needed to.
Well, The Islander is your latest book. I believe it's not got a cover that has a cavorting couple on it just yet. That might be the paperback version. You've written it with Chris Blackwell, who obviously is the head honcho, as we say.
It's Chris's autobiography.
Yeah.
I like being a ghost occasionally. I was the ghost of Grace Jones, which I think is
one of
my favourite things I've ever done.
That's a great...
Yeah, ghost of Grace
Jones. We should have just introduced you like that. And we have with us the ghost of Grace Jones.
The ghost of Grace Jones.
So tell us about this book, anyway.
The story of Chris Blackwell, therefore the story of Island Records to an extent, from the very beginning, late 50s in Jamaica. I'm working on records in Jamaica in the late 50s, early 60s, moving to London pretty much when independence happened in Jamaica, launching Island Records in London in 1962, still a reggae label for 3 or 4 years, and then gradually transforming into a different kind of label as well, with English psychedelic rock. And you signed the Spencer Davis Group very early on, and that led to Traffic, and then that led to an Island that became one of the great, if not the greatest, sort of independent record labels in history. And I'm kind of interested also, a certain period of time has come to an end, if you like. And Chris is one of those figures, you think of your Andrew Lou Goldhams and your Brian Epsteins and even your McLarens and the great rock managers, the Albert Grossman, these kind of iconoclastic figures in rock music that don't exist anymore in that form. They've mutated into other things, whether that's an Elon Musk or a Kanye West or whatever it is they've mutated into, a showrunner, Stephen Moffat or something. But I'm just interested in this type of figure that's sort of entering history, if you like. And Chris is... it'd been quite private over the years and always behind the scenes. It was only two or three times, if that, photographed with Bob Marley. He preferred to keep away. It was from a world where record producers and record company guys you never knew who they were. They were mysteries. But now he figured that it was time to tell his history. We've been talking about it for a long time, 20, 30 years.
Obviously, you've written about Tony Wilson extensively, and the Tony Wilson book was out, was it last year?
Yeah.
Chris Blackwell is a very different figure. As you're saying, he chooses to be behind the curtain as such, whereas Tony was very much at the forefront. Yeah. What kind of... I mean, could Island Records have existed without Chris Blackwell?
No. It's his work of art in the way that, say, Factory was for Tony. You know, they're not particularly musicians, and they're not particularly... anything you could put your finger on what it is they do or don't do. But those kind of figures, I mean, influenced, you know, by the guys in America that would have done Sun Records or Atlantic or Elektra, you know, your Jack Holtzmans and people like that. You know, the idea of a record label being a theatre almost, a piece of theatre, an artwork in itself. And Chris and you know, Chris Blackwell is definitely an influence on Tony Wilson to an extent in the terms of creating an identity for a label, but also the disruptive figure for Tony would have been McLaren,
Right.
So there's different types of you know, sort of impresarios,
yes,
and people who mix the business, and they create things, they create, yeah, situations, they make things happen, they put people together. Chris and Tony shared that very much.
Mm. You mentioned Grace Jones earlier. She's in the book, obviously, but I was surprised there aren't that many scandalous stories of her. We don't get your other book here. He's very polite about her and doesn't really give much away.
Well, Chris is a witness to,
yeah,
a lot of things.
I bet.
And Chris being Chris will not give away the secrets, you know. I mean, that's part of Chris, isn't it? he wanders, yeah, through. There, yeah, he is, you know, very early on with Errol Flynn, Noel Coward, Ian Fleming.
I was going to say, Errol Flynn seemed to have taught him to deal with quote-unquote difficult
artists. It's what he says, you know,
yeah,
after being hanging out with Errol Flynn in Jamaica in the 1950s, yeah, tearing
it apart. He seemed to have had it away with his mother, maybe.
Inventing celebrity status, if,
yes,
you like. You know, but by the time he gets to Marianne Faithfull, Grace John Baker, who he worked with, Blind Faith.
Yeah, yeah.
He wanders through it. Chris is a great wanderer. He's very nomadic. There's, mm, a sense of him just wandering along a beach, leaving footprints. The footprints happen to be these great records, this great label, these great studios like Compass Point. But Chris is just wandering through, and he's got that sense. You know, early doors, he's meeting Miles Davis and,
yes,
hanging out with Miles,
incredible,
Davis and,
yeah,
and getting experience that way.
Yeah.
But he won't really let on. He won't really let on intentionally about a lot of things. So, you know, the book in that sense is very much about the process he had making a record, being in the studio, putting things together, making the John Martin album One World at his home in Thiel in near Reading, and using his house as a sort of musical instrument, and the garden and the lake outside, and making this extraordinary record, putting different musicians together. It's very much that, and Compass Point, and putting Grace's band together at Compass Point.
Yeah, yeah.
Chris wanted to tell those stories. So we don't necessarily understand what happened maybe between Grace and Sean Connery, or, you know, these stories. That's another world, and probably needs a biography rather than an autobiography to,
right,
tell, you know.
Right, I get you. Alex, you wanted to ask a couple of questions.
I was really fascinated by the way he talks about Richard Branson in the tail end of the book, because they obviously knew each other quite well at some point. And then he talks about Branson as one of those billionaires who are launching rockets into space, and kind of juxtaposes himself having a quiet ranch sort of farm in Jamaica. That he actually says, I bought a big tree and everything that went with it. It got me thinking that entire generation have kind of divided into two streams of people who now run the world and hippies who stayed hippies, essentially. And do we not have enough of him in position of power and a little too much of the other?
You mean Chris? Mm. Chris has been much more a softer influence on things, if you like. Mm. You know, there is an influence on Jamaica, an influence on Jamaican politics and its sort of environment, but not as visible as celebrity-based as Branson. You know, Chris, there's a line in the book I particularly like where Chris suddenly mentions how he first saw Talking Heads with Andy Warhol. And I kept asking him about them, because where's this come from? What do you mean you're hanging out with Andy? You know, but he doesn't really want to talk about that. He's not going to go on TV and sell his brand. He's not. What he likes doing is giving people like Branson the initial space that they go on and create their brand. So, you know, the first person that gives Branson a sort of distribution deal and encourages him is Chris. So there's a lot of Chris influencing people who do go on. And you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of those hippies in the 60s found music as a way of expressing themselves. And then some of them dropped the music and went on to do other things. And music was an expedient way into creating a brand, maybe for Richard Branson, more than Chris. Whereas Chris, it's the music.
It was the music.
And then he moves on via studios to hotels, and he loves the hotels. I mean, he creates Golden. I've been watching the Depp Moss world in this week, and of course where that happened, the Depp Moss incident, is
at
Chris's
house.
Hotel Goldeneye.
Yeah.
And Chris loves the idea that he brings people there. Steve Jobs is over there, Elon Musk is over there, Beyonce, and so he's still creating a scene that he's sort of wandering through, but he's actually brought it into his own domestic environment.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because of where the book leaves off. We leave it with him and his resorts basically closed, travel still largely suspended, and a sort of insecurity about the future and all those jobs and all of that. And I was wondering whether you had a bit of an update for us. Has everything reopened? Are numbers where they were? Is everyone doing okay, basically? Well,
Jamaica's recovering and the numbers are getting better. It's you know, Chris wanted to be quite honest about that sense of the later life, and a lot of his colleagues and people he's worked with directly and indirectly starting to die. You know, there's a melancholy to it, because it's a book about memory as much as anything else. We can all go on about the glamour and the amazing world this is and these astonishing records, but it's also a life that comes to an end. And in the last couple of years, a lot of people around him have been, you know, the Toots has gone, Robbie Shakespeare has gone, Charlie Watts, you know, he was almost there the first time Charlie Watts ever played with the Rolling Stones, you know. Mm. And there's that sense of that fading away is kind of interesting and honest, I think, rather than, you know, because it's a book also about a period in time that's sort of gone away, as much as there is a sense, I think we're going to find that this out in a minute with Liam Gallagher, of people still holding on to the idea of the album. We have to be honest and say those days have gone. They were amazing and astonishing and wonderful.
What I was going to ask, and we can talk a lot about, because factory days have gone, and that was, you know, a far more recent history. Are things like TikTok, from the Paul Morley view, changing the way that people consume culture, or changing the way that pop stars have to be pop stars four times a day on TikTok again? Can you see an evolution there, or it's just we're all doomed?
Well, there's definitely an evolution. I mean, this only might be a transitional period anyway into a state of being that we're just rehearsing.
Yeah, right.
It's not necessary. I mean, to some it's probably the thing, but it moves very quickly. My feeling is it's very much just a rehearsal for whatever does come next, which will be extraordinary in terms of stretching humanity into many different shapes. But also what's interesting is the new, you know, platforms, programs, whatever they're called. They all inherit the 50, 60 years of popular culture at the moment. So they're reheating, slicing up, dicing, remaking. It's all in that image.
Yeah.
So as much as it's new technology, you know, it's a new technology, everything about it is people of certainly even my generation and older can recognize the echoes and where it's come from. There's nothing intrinsically innovative within the formats that is equal to the format. And of course, when, you know, the other technological advancements came along, the vinyl and the recording studio, et cetera, the art that went with it was as innovative, if not more, than the technology. At the moment, it seems to be the technologies ahead.
Yes,
and what's the content
is
essentially a sort of digestion of the last 50, 60 years of popular culture.
Yeah, so I'm interested, top the boxes all at once.
Yes, I'm interested in what will be the format that is unleashed by the technology, instead of the technology just needing, like a parasite. It's very Wyndham in that sense, which is why that did remind me that what the disturbance is the internet, and the children themselves are the TikTokers. You know, that's why we're so scared of them, because we don't know how to talk to them. We don't know what they're going on about. We pretend we know, and we might even do one ourselves, but we don't know. And I think we're very much in that state. So that's hence my role, I guess, as I've ended up as Paul Gambaccini once called me, and I was a bit insulted at the time, but I understood what he meant, a historian. It's just interesting, that period of time, what was it? Was it just to supply this next transitional period with its material, or did it have a greater purpose? Or is it just something, as Liam knows full well, is it just something to be nostalgic about? You know,
it was this unusual post-war period. I think we always thought that, would this last forever?
But yes.
Recorded music hasn't been around that long. It defined youth culture for a bit.
Yeah.
And that period ended probably in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Because I think we still can't get over it.
Yeah, where's the next Acid House? And it's not coming, guys. Right. The next Acid House is your iPad.
It's probably an app or a platform.
Yeah, it's not music.
That's right. That's what they queue up for now. They don't queue up for Rolling Stones tickets. They queue up for the new Apple.
Yes.
And it is true that, you know, they say, what's the new, you know, what's the new Sex Pistols? Yeah. The new Sex Pistols was, is it a cake?
Yeah.
Because you know, they're looking in the wrong area.
Yeah,
you know?
They're looking at this old-fashioned thing of recorded post-war music. Yes. It's over.
It's over, kids. Sorry,
get over. It's just another thing.
Yeah, but it's not over, kids. It's over, grown-ups.
It's over. It's just a thing that happened. We can still use its great culture, but it's just one more.
Dear. And on that note, maybe we should
to celebrate.
Maybe we should rename the programme.
Okay, well,
you can get the Islander.
This is going to be an awkward segue. So every week we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite track of theirs. to show how with it they are. Paul, what's yours and why do you love it?
Oh, it's Mary Halverson, Night Shift. Mary Halverson's an extraordinary guitar player. She comes sort of out of Hendrix, but also Derek Bailey and Jim Hall and Nola Jotti. She's been making records for 10, 15, 20 years. She's just released what is essentially a double album on Nonesuch. You can also get it at two separate CDs. I love her playing because it shows to me that within all the noise and within all the chaos of streaming, et cetera, there's still a kind of strange logical progression to a certain sort of music. And I hear in Mary, you know, music that comes out of Annette Peacock and Robert Wyatt, who she's worked with, and prog like Caravan and that side of prog, Soft Machine, Matching Mole, also bop, bebop, and experimental improvised music. Like Derek Bailey, you know, where it all intersects. But also it does seem as if it is 2022, and it's a record, you know, she made during the pandemic, still searching, still curious. She's got so many ideas. It's a guitar player that basically, you know, in one piece of music has about 100 ideas, and that's still something that turns me on, you know, the idea that the music isn't necessarily just its sonic display, but also the ideas and what it's saying about being alive at a certain time. Those pandemic records are interesting in terms of, you know...
We love that sort of jazzy wonkiness on this show.
Oh, that's the phrase I was looking for, yes. You see, I'm rusty.
We'll drop Night Shift from a Amaryllis by Mary Halverson on our playlists, and here's a little taste of it now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Right, some more music. You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you can get Liam Gallagher. Liam's third solo album, Come On You Know, is released this weekend. Still a fan of the Lennon-McCartney leitmotif? Will this zip our parka or leave us shivering at the door? Let's listen to the track Better Days from the album to get us in the spirit. Here's a taster. Open up your eyes, cause you're really... Anthony Teasdale, I am going to start with you. You're from
like
the north. Anthony Teasdale, have you done your homework? Does Liam Gallagher still do it for you, if he ever did?
What would I say? This isn't really my sort of thing.
Cop out.
But I thought for what it was, I thought it was surprisingly good.
Mm-hmm. And what does it do?
It does... Have you ever heard of Oasis? It sounds a bit like that. So if you like Oasis or the Stone Roses, you know, or Rick Witter, then you'll like this. And I thought it was decent at what it did. You know, it sounds like I'm damning it with fake praise here.
It does.
But
it,
fair
it,
play, yeah. He's done it. He's gone off his arse, done it. And he's done a good job of it. It's not my sort of thing, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was catchy. I thought he sounded very optimistic on there. He's found what he is. And I thought it was accomplished at what it was, yeah. So, you know, I'm a bit of a... I mean, I like him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, I can't enthusiast, enthusiastic about it that much because it's not my sort of thing, but I thought it was good at what it was. Don't come. Okay. It's not a cop. That's not a cop. Is that a cop out?
I don't know. I was going to say the same thing, you know.
Well, my question to you.
Well, now you're going to have to say something different.
If Liam didn't exist, would we have to invent him?
Well, yes, because one of the things I find most fascinating is the notion of 30, 40 years of rock and roll history and the idea of being the rebel in rock and roll mm-hmm. being turned into what is essentially content. I mean, he's having to make content. He's having to make content so he can keep going and playing the festivals. And therefore, it's an album that's for those people that go to those festivals mm-hmm. and wave their hands in the air and want that kind of optimism. So, but it's interesting seeing it turned into content, even within the fact that he's still trying to represent himself as a maverick figure from you know the 1970s. Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of my favourite things, and in a way I would have preferred to have reviewed this, is just the trailer for the Liam Gallagher documentary that's on Sky a lot at the minute, when he seems to say something about tofu, and then he is what he is, plays a bit of pool, about 2 minutes, 2 seconds of music. And that, to me, is the perfect encapsulation of the Liam Gallagher I love having around. Mm. I'm very pleased I'll never have to listen to this again, not in a negative way, but it's just that it is for a certain kind of, you know, consumer, if you like. And they wouldn't like to be called consumers because there's still the illusion that it's, you know, it's rock and roll rebellion. And it wears those clothes, you know, as well it's ever going to do. I'm always surprised. I loved it back in, you know, what was called the day when a pop career would last about 2 years and then they'd have to go off to Butlins.
Well, the idea that we're saying old is at 24, weren't
yeah, we
you?
Were old at 24, absolutely.
At 24. You weren't expecting to have a career after
I'm probably foolishly, and people tell me off for this, still incredibly surprised that this now goes on for 30 years and it's okay.
Yeah.
And it seems to, you know, got to be offensive to a fundamental idea about the music itself that it then incredibly instantly contradicts. But of course, those rules were all made up anyway, and why shouldn't they go on for 30 years? But it just strikes me as being, I mean, I'm looking forward to Liam at 70. I hope I hang on to see it because you know, I always thought this generation would have, the 90s generation would have the most growing up, most trouble growing up, if you like.
Right.
Because there was a lattice boyishness about what they were doing, mostly, if you'll forgive me for, well, it was pretty much mostly a sort of male sickness, if you like, for the 60s. And I was just intrigued about how they would grow up, and they're sort of growing up pretty much as I thought. The Parkers get more expensive and more designery, but they're essentially still. So Liam's Parker, that's what I like about that Sky trailer. I'm looking at that Parker thinking,
nice.
I mean, nice. I am that age, and my whole life is Instagram accounts
the overstitching
with
on it
Stone
really nice.
Island. Parker,
that's right.
You know, I always say, everyone's a socialist till it comes to football and coats. Do you know, and that's this the coat is everything.
So if we were reviewing his coat, I'd be up there with 5 stars. But the record, I'm unfortunately, you know, down in 1 star. But that's just because, you know, when it begins and you think, I don't want to be told within 10 seconds in my head, oh, that's that Rolling Stone, that's that from 1966, you know. But that's a personal thing, and that's my own sickness. So who am I to disparage the sickness of other people who love that nostalgia, you know?
Yeah, you're talking about more power.
That's the one.
Yes, which has the children's choir on it, which is completely, you can't always get what you want. Alex, now there are moments in this album where he talks about vulnerability. I think he is trying to evolve as a Liam Gallagher into the next decade. There's a bit where he talks about, I'm sick of acting like I'm tough. Come on, baby, give us a hug. Did it work for you?
To be honest, I don't know what I can add to the sentence, this has gone on for 30 years and it's okay, which is both a perfect review and sounds like a lyric from the album. I come to this, I was determined to listen to this without the baggage of everything we know and everything that's
and there's a lot of baggage
gone into it, and there's a lot of baggage. And I found that the music made it quite difficult for me to do that because it has exactly that walk and that swagger and like everything about it is Gallagher.
Because he can't change that because that's the content that's expected. So
I guess he's
trapped.
But I thought within that, so if you look at it as an exercise of someone being given a really narrow brief, a really specific envelope, and still managing to explore different stuff within that, I thought it had some really good tunes on it. I thought I really appreciated the optimism of it, actually. There's a couple of tracks. Don't Go Halfway, I really liked. I really liked Too Good for Giving Up. Mm-hmm. The final lyric is, the universe will provide a guiding hand, a crack of light. You're too good for giving up. And, I mean, it does all sound a little bit like you fed every Oasis and Gallagher solo project into AI and asked it to produce something out of all of that.
Which it probably was how they made it, because the technology does exist to do that.
Citation needed, Paul Morley.
Well, you know what I mean. Those of us that do talking books are fully aware now that robots are doing the majority of talking books. You know, the technology does exist.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Sorry, which bit? I don't know why I'm talking about myself now. If you have 3 seconds of a voice, you can basically create that. You know, you get that voice there for the whole to read the whole bloody Bible in that voice. So
I mean, I never thought it would fall to me as a sort of opera fan and Blur aficionado to defend Gallagher, but it never annoyed me, and that's quite a lot nowadays, isn't it? I don't find myself rushing for the pause button because I've had enough.
First listen, I thought it was the worst album I'd ever heard because the robot was being Liam Gallagher. And I just thought, how can you get away with this? When it's dead, it doesn't even die. Nothing's new. Nothing's cool. I just thought, oh, my God, this is awful. I hate it. I hate it. I want to put on our WhatsApp. I hate this. Second listening, I thought was absolute work of genius because it's meta. And there's something about it. I saw what he was doing. And once I got what he was doing, I thought, you're doing this really, really well. As you say, the remit is so narrow.
Yes.
He's done it.
I feel strongly that artists of a certain age, that your output a lot of the time is about giving things to your audience, but that you're allowed after a certain age to do stuff that asks for a bit of love back. And I don't find anything terrible about that.
It's his job. I think you're right. It's his job. You know, Liam Gallagher is Liam Gallagher. His job has been Liam Gallagher. And Liam Gallagher is like he's like being a chippy, isn't he, right? So if he's a chippy, he has to go make tables and fit kitchens. Mm. That's what he does. Liam Gallagher has to make Liam Gallagher records because then that gets him booked.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
As Paul said.
And when the customer walks in, they don't want a Thai curry.
Yeah,
they want cod and chips.
Yeah,
and that's what he wraps up and gives them. And it's bloody good cod and chips, as it were.
It doesn't have to be interesting all the time.
Yeah. So, if you review it under a different category, it's a classic.
And with that, I think we should leave it.
Now, on to literature. Winners of the International Booker Prize typically see a 500% rise in sales year on year. So last week, I sauntered off to the South Bank Centre to catch up with one of this year's 6 shortlisted writers and one of my absolute favourites. Miyako Kawakami is the author of the devastatingly brutal book Heaven, which is translated by Sam Bett and David Boyd. Her replies are voiced via her interpreter, Hiromi Sakai.
Well, firstly, Miyako, congratulations on your book being selected for the International Booker Prize. Heaven is your second novel to be translated into English, and you bring your visceral, perhaps often brutally honest writing to the subject of schools and young people. Can you tell me what brought you to write about bullying?
When I write novels, usually there are several, multiple different themes overlapping to each other, and they start taking shape as I write. But in this instance, there was this absolute violence imposed on the victims. And how those vulnerable people who have no power will fight and survive, and how they can have hope, and how their friendship, what will happen to the friendship between the two victims. So I wanted to know the answers to these questions by writing this novel.
Let's come on and talk about Breasts and Eggs, which was your first novel to be translated into English. There were 2 translators for Breasts and Eggs, one for the dialogue and one for the prose. And much of the book is written in this very rich Osakan dialect, which draws on these traditions of tragicomedy and using humour as social coping. Can you tell me a bit about that translation process? How did you pick your translators? Do you feel like that the whole message of the book comes across?
10 years ago, I met David in a translation workshop. Even that time, his understanding about Japanese literature was so profound, and his love also was profound. So I wanted to work with somebody to translate who is from the same generation, and David is. That's important for me because, of course, gender is important, but to be born in the same generation means that we have shared experience because we were the same sort of age. Having acquired the help of David was a kind of ideal for me. And then David brought in Sam to help him. And then we started working as a trisome. Osaka dialect, it's called dialect, but really the true beauty of Osaka dialect is not in the dialect itself. It's actually an established culture itself. So therefore, we took a long time, the three of us, took a long time to discuss how the dialogue should be translated. We started with just an idea from using rap. In the end, the two translators decided that those three protagonists, the three ladies in the novel, we should look at in what kind of room they live in, what kind of dresses they put on, what's the speed of their dialogue, and that sort of things. So we just looked at how they live their lives.
Let's come on and talk about the existing literary canon of Japanese authors. There are lots of non-Japanese readers who will still stereotype literature, especially from Asian women, as being about quiet, subservient women. I've read things about the fact that Japanese literature focuses on cats, for instance. And Mieko, I know you're one of few authors who's interviewed Haruki Murakami, and you challenged him over his depiction of women characters in his novels. Do you think that there are still some outdated tropes that dominate our idea of literature from Japan?
In various levels in Japanese society, women are not well-respected enough yet. And you can just take a simple story of birth control pills that you can't just buy off the drugstore, or even the marriage system that it's against women. Therefore, it's still in Japan, women are still controlled by people who are not women. It hasn't changed. Having said that, lots of people in English-speaking world and also from Asia, people are expecting this situation. I think their expectation is growing that this situation will improve. And another thing I want to add is that if you think about Japan, lots of people think about Tokyo, but that's not true, because in Japan, not everybody lives like people in Tokyo. We still have differences in wealth and social standings, and we are not an equal society. We have some history to think about. So I don't want to write books that just meet satisfied readers who expect Japan to be homogenous and everybody is the same and women are obedient and quiet. I don't want to write books like that. And then my readers have accepted that. They loved my books and I'm very, very happy and glad about that.
I'm certainly one of those readers who's loved those books. So if Breasts and Eggs was about the plurality of womanhood and Heaven is about bullying, what can we expect from the book you've just released, All the Lovers in the Night?
All the Lovers in the Night. The latest book, All the Lovers in the Night, has two themes. One is light, one is language of words, and the existence as human beings. The world is full of light, but we don't know what light is, really. What is it? And also the words. We don't know where words came from. Human existence is very similar to the existence of the light and the words. So I wanted to depict that aspect of light and words and human existence with some poetry incorporated into the book.
Thank you both ever so much for talking to me today.
Now, some music. We are still in the habit of asking our esteemed guests to bring in a current track for us all to listen to around the campfire of our minds. And I'm going to ask you, Anthony Teasdale, what you have brought in for us.
Well, I've brought in this virtual meta double vinyl import.
Look at it.
Which I will open up on my jeans like people in Eastern Bloc Records used to do.
He's actually doing the mime.
Because there is a way of doing this that was very sought after, that you would open up an import record, the cellophane on it, on your jeans, and only
Never
the most of gifted this. Of record shop at
assistants would be able to do this. The rest would be putting nails in or knives. There is a way of doing
it. We learned something on this.
And I say, he opens that LP.
Yeah,
very
tell us about
well.
Music, though, Tony, because we haven't got all day.
Right, okay. So I've brought in the new Mr. Fingers album. Now, Mr. Fingers did Can You Feel It? And he's like the incredibly tasteful. He's like the habitat of Deep House. And I again, in a way, it's a bit like the Liam Gallagher thing. When this came, I've always been a fan of him. He's called Larry Heard. And really, I've always loved his sort of like soulful machine music. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And his new album sounds like it could have been made 34 years ago in Chicago. It's incredibly pleasant, tasteful, deep house. Some slow stuff, some soul stuff on there. And I knew exactly what I was going to get when it came up. Mm-hmm. And it's great. And I don't expect anything more. Mm. You know, I think, and especially in electronic music, which for years was all about constant change. So, you know, house comes, techno comes, then jungle comes, drum and bass comes, two-step garage comes, grime comes, all this bang, 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 all these new genres. And then, like everything else, it sort of ran out.
Yeah.
And then it's just being made. And I think house music was music made originally for kids in clubs in Chicago. And now it's made for graphic designers to listen to while they're working from home. You know.
I think you've put it there very well.
Very poetic, yes.
We have cleared this so that we can listen to a little bit. This is Around the Sun, Mr. Fingers.
Six years after the original, Tom Cruise returns for Top Gun Maverick, Still Wood. The film follows Captain Pete Maverick Mitchell's return to the United States fighter program known as Top Gun, where he must face past demons as he trains a group of young fighter pilots for a mission that, at first glance, seems a bit, well, impossible. Here's a little trailer.
30 plus years of service. Combat medals, citations. Only man to shoot down 3 enemy planes in the last 40 years. Yet you can't get a promotion, you won't retire. Despite your best efforts, you refuse to die. You should be at least a 2-star admiral by now. Yet here you are. Captain. Why is that?
It's one of life's mysteries, sir.
Sean, we went to the movies together to see this.
We did, didn't we?
Popcorn and everything. Yeah. It was a date. great propaganda works because it bypasses the brain. The original Top Gun was the zenith or nadir, depending on your view, of the Reagan era. It was basically an extended version of South Park's America Fuck Yeah. Mm. Does the sequel reflect on this or just extend it?
Well, you may not be surprised to know that I haven't seen the first one. Because it wasn't one of the films I would have gone to see. I'm sorry, everybody.
You should watch it now, because you will watch it with an incredible meta eye.
But I thought that gave me quite a clear view on, let's go and see this film and what is it like.
So you saw it fresh.
I saw it absolutely fresh. No idea what the first one was about. I think it was about flying a plane. And my mind sat down and didn't want to like it. By the end, I thought it was absolutely incredible. And having heard Tom Cruise talk about it, what it is cinema. And he knows how to do cinema. And cinema is about exhilaration. It's about pacing. Mm. It's not necessarily about plot. It's not necessarily about the characters within it, because there are types.
It's certainly not about plot.
Yes, yes. But there are points, and I was saying to you afterwards, it reminds me of a Clouseau film called Wages of Fear, which is a 1950s film, which is You are on the edge of your seat during a sequence which is just two people driving a truck, but they happen to be driving nitroglycerin. So there is no way that they can disturb it, otherwise bang. It was like that, and there are these incredible fighting scenes and these incredible aviation scenes that are completely that. Pure cinema, no mind, you know, it's bodily, it's physical. It's this alchemy of what cinema can do and what a giant image will do to you and how caught up you get in it. And that is fascinating. And
yeah, I mean, a film like that lives and dies or dies by its action sequences.
Yeah, of course.
And they were incredible. Yeah. You know, at times it almost felt like you were in a simulator.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you got the fight or flight sensation as if you were in a plane that was falling and all of that. Kelly McGillis, who was a little older and quite a bit taller than Tom, even at the time of the original. She does not return.
No.
She is replaced by the younger and rather frighteningly thin-looking Jennifer Connelly.
Yes.
But there's a lady pilot. What does all this tell us?
I'm not sure that dissecting the female roles in this will give us much joy, to be honest. The Jennifer Connelly character isn't terribly fleshed out, and she doesn't really have a real job. She's not an aviator. You know, she doesn't drive a fast car. You know, one of the stills of it is her sitting on the back of the motorbike with Tom Cruise. You think, ouch, it is 2022. The female pilot is okay, but she fits in with the boys. I was interested, and I want to ask you, that I heard it's not as homoerotic as the first one, but it's incredibly homoerotic, this film.
Homoerotic as the first
one. Oh, okay.
There's a lot of, you know, Tom's trailing fingers caressing phallic parts of a plane.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that going on.
What did you feel about the well-oiled muscles on the beach that suddenly just play a game of catch, it looks like?
I mean,
there's a lot of male torsos.
Equivalent. You haven't seen the original. It was a beach volleyball game.
Okay, is this?
And was very competitive.
Yeah.
And in this one, it was a beach American football game.
Okay.
And it was for team building. So they weren't kind of playing off against each other. Do you see how America has changed now? How they're now one family? A lot of it was nostalgia. The beach game, the bike and jacket are exactly the same, only a little bit beaten up, like Tom still would. He's shirtless a lot.
Yeah,
he climbs out of his girlfriend's. He climbs out of his girlfriend's window at one point, like a college kid.
Yeah.
The opening sequence is entirely recreated to the sound of Kenny Loggins' "Danger Zone," and I just think it is part nostalgia aimed at people who saw the original and want to believe they've still got it. You know.
Yeah.
But part aimed at a younger audience because it works as an action movie. I mean, that's my potted review. I wanted to hate it, and annoyingly,
it's quite good.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Right, finally, regular listeners know, and there are loads of you, aren't there? We also ask our guests to bring in their favourite songs of all time, not just current, and we add it to our playlist. Why not? Paul Morley, what have you chosen?
Babies on Fire, Brian Eno, an Island record, actually, you know, because Island records were always so great. And that period of 73 when Brian Eno sort of left Roxy Music and you didn't think, and then suddenly he's making that album This Is What I Want Roxy Music to Sound Like, really, and indeed Down the Line Talking Heads, and even you too, you never know. And he's making No Pussyfooting, you know, that wonderful sort of post Terry Riley, Steve Reich sort of loop. Incredibly exciting. I still, you know, playing it now, it just sounds incredibly like it's still going to be around, and you'd hear it in 2017 and it would sound new. Bonkers pop, my favourite kind of pop. Experimental pop, my favourite kind of pop. And it was on, you know, absolutely an Island Records record. You know, when you were buying things, you suddenly noticed that everything you'd bought that year seemed to be on Island Records.
Yeah, and when you started buying records because they were on that label.
And you thought the label had essays, you know, written by Jacques Derrida printed on it, because in your mind they did, because they were so exciting, because you thought you were getting something else. And even opening it, as you were saying, was the most remarkable thing you'd ever done in your life. Opening the record to take it out was a revelation.
I was always a thumbnail person.
Oh, really? Yeah. Did you have a special
gauge? Yeah. No, I kept my thumbnail slightly longer to go down there.
Mm. Nice. Anthony Teasdale, what's your best tune ever?
Well, this week, my best tune ever is, because obviously it changes, doesn't it? You know, it's Duran Duran, The Chauffeur, which is on the B-side of Rio. Yeah. And that B-side of Rio is everything that a young lad in suburban Merseyside dreamed about.
Mm.
And that this was an impossibly glamorous world of Anthony Price suits and leather jackets and high-rise apartments and helicopters and living in Manhattan. And this song is, I mean, it's incredibly subtle. It starts with like an 808 drum machine, and then eventually the drums come in as Simon Le Bon is singing about, you know, driving his lady around. And it's for a 14, well, how old was I then? I was 10. I was it was very fruity as well. You know, there is you know, I mean, I think Simon
pop music is for
Simon Le Bon. He paints this fantastic picture, you know, and it I just can see it now. You know, maybe it's in Miami or something tropical about it, and it's incredibly glamorous. And it's a brilliant banging tune, and that whole B-side of Rio is fantastic, futuristic synth pop, which I love.
And with that, we're at the end of the podcast and it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we strip down to our boxers and play a nice and oily game of catch on the beach? Tony, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, sad news this morning that Andy Fletcher from Depeche Mode died. You know, it's stuff like that's really unexpected, isn't it? We just don't expect people to die who look young.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that, like, you know, like you were talking about Tom Cruise before, you know. 60-odd-year-old man who's
Ray Liotta as well.
Yeah, Ray Liotta. And you're like, oh, these people are meant to be here for another 25 to 30 years. We're meant to enjoy them more.
Mm.
So that took me... I had a look, something which is incredibly joyful, which is the first film you've seen of Depeche Mode appearing at Crocs in Basildon.
Mm.
And So Basildon is, you know, as you know, a new town that's probably a little bit like an upmarket Skelmersdale. All the kids, there's some new romantics there in this sort of like Essex New Town. They go to this club and Depeche Mode are doing an early gig. And they're playing New Life and it's just absolutely...
And they look
just
so young, don't
they're
they?
They're just like these like little lads. Yeah. And yeah, the sound is just fantastic. Mm. And the reporter's going, and the Depeche Mode fans don't look at the stage. They dance to themselves. And which is me as a raver is my sort of thing, not looking at the stage. Mm. And the sound is absolutely brilliant and joyful and futuristic and life-affirming and wonderful. And that's where it took me today and how much I love that sound. And that's the sound of me being a little lad thinking, I love this. And I just thought, oh, how incredibly sad. So that's, a bit of a bum note to start the program.
Alex, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I have to give a plug to a new sister podcast called Origin Story with Dorian Lynskey and Ian Dunt. Been listening to that voraciously. It's all about terms that are misused today, like McCarthyism or neoliberal or stuff like that, and looking at where they originate from and what they actually mean and how we're using them wrongly with Ian Dunt and Dorian Lynskey. Just very, very good. But my actual recommendation would be we did a little podcast with Arthur Snell recently on sort of what someone intimidated by classical music and opera can use to kind of get into it. And in that vein, there's a Carmen opening on the 2nd of June at Opera Holland Park.
Okay.
So if you're in London or you want to come to London for a little weekend, you can go have a little picnic. And it is a perfect, perfect introduction to that kind of music. It's really accessible as a story.
Yeah.
Everything's good.
It's
clear.
It's one of the only ones I can stand.
Yeah, there's dialogue, there's surtitles. Yeah. So, you know, the mezzo-soprano singing Carmen, Kezia Bienek, is tremendous. I've had the luck to be present at some of their rehearsals. Cecilia Stinton is directing. A female director really brings something to this story, which is basically about an abusive relationship. And Lee Reynolds conducts very well. Mm-hmm. So look for the Opera Holland Park website. And if you want something easily accessible that will get you into this, perfect, perfect starter.
One thing that's been really annoying me is between 9 and 11 o'clock, I'm having a slight trouble just alighting on a TV programme to watch because I'm usually ready to start watching TV about 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And they've moved this morning to 10 o'clock, which has slightly annoyed me because that's thrown me because I was used to it starting at 10:30.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, you set your watch by it.
Yeah, so I'm still not comfortable I'm going to this morning at 10 o'clock. So I've started watching Jeremy Vine at 10 o'clock, actually.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really infuriating me is the fact that even though some people call in and say, will you stop calling our Prime Minister Boris? Because in a way, it sort of, you
it's
know,
a term of
softens,
isn't it? Yeah.
And it's part of his stick. It's part of his McLaren-esque manipulation of this image of Al Johnson, as his probably his real name is, but somehow he's a cuddly character and not of the hard right. And so even though it's pointed out to them, and Jeremy in his colourful shirt has been agreeing with it, they will still flash up in every single caption, it's Boris. And that's been making me incredibly angry.
Yes, I can imagine. Can you ring up? It's
funny you should say that because just lately, you know, before the internet, obviously, the whole world was filled with people who rang in radio programs and you ignored, whereas the whole world has turned into those people now. But I've suddenly started to find myself interested in what happened if I ring in and just make a claim. But what I've noticed that people are saying, will you stop doing this? Because it is not necessary. And he is Johnson. If you're going to say it's Johnson. Sounds petty, but it's just really annoying because it is so much that he has created a character, and we've all fallen through.
It's annoying.
And a bit like we were talking about Liam Gallagher in a way. You know, it's what made me think of the Liam Gallagher album as being almost the perfect soundtrack to the Johnson era in many ways, because it's the construction of something.
Yes, because Boris Johnson's political career is the album, isn't it? Because he wants to go and do something completely different.
Yes, and
afterwards, he's not interested in being
interesting.
Prime
seeing the meet. I felt this funnily enough when Jordan suddenly decided to call herself Katie Price.
Yeah.
Everyone agreed.
Yeah.
Well, yes, hang I on a minute. Yeah, excuse me. No.
Why are we all playing along with this?
Yes,
I wanted to be known. So
these
things do keep me up for a couple of minutes, usually at 10 o'clock in the morning when I'm just about to have my morning nap, being in my 60s.
What about you, Sean?
Oh, well, it's another sad one. R.I.P. Cathal Coughlan. From, obviously, Micro Disney, Fatima Mansions, but also we talked about his new album just a couple of months ago, Telefiche, that he did with Jackknife Lee. I knew Cathal slightly. I hadn't seen him for a long time, but it hit me really, really hard this week. I do think some people have said he was Ireland's greatest songwriter of the past couple of decades. He absolutely superlative music, an amazing mind, but also a really lovely person. And I kind of miss him already, and I feel odd that it's hit me, but I really, really miss him already. I felt really sad this week. I think it's a real loss, and only 61. So, R.I.P. Cathal. Mm. My thoughts are with the family. Really
and that's
are.
The end of the podcast. Thanks so much to Paul Morley and Anthony Teasdale for joining us on the Culture Bunker. Thank you, guys. Remember, you can get all the tunes on our playlists. The links are at the top of the show notes.
And it's the bank holiday next weekend, so the Culture Bunker is taking a week off because we're going to be hiding from the monarchists. We'll be back on Saturday the 11th of June with more pop culture insight, unless it's eaten itself already.
Until then, from me and Sean, and from producers Alex Rees, Yelena Sofronievich and Alina Ganatra, thank you for listening.
And in memory of Cathal Coughlan, we're going to play out with something from the last album he made with Jackknife Lee, as I said, Telefiche. Here's The Symphonies of Danny LaRue, and here's to Cathal.
Kenneth angers Lucifer rising. Camden 84 show. The audience mostly tripping. Soundtrack missing, so here's ELO. Beat down in London town. Pass the amulets around. Well oiled social blend. Plans can be announced through champing teeth and cotton mouths. When I get money, you know what I'll do. The symphonies of